Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not like the credit market's going to come unstuck overnight. There are some serious structural issues that have to be worked through first. But there was the faintest glimmer of hope today that frozen liquidity might actually be getting liquid again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 7th of April. This one's a Monday, and it is so good to have you with us. We got the first inkling the frozen credit markets might be beginning to thaw last Tuesday when Lehman Brothers was able to sell off $4 billion worth of fancy new stock. No mean feat at a time when most people on Wall Street aren't in a trusting mood, and especially with a bank that for a time there was rumored to be as badly off as Bear Stearns. Well, we woke up today to a pair of promising signs. First, that Washington Mutual, one of this country's largest and most troubled mortgage lenders, is close to nailing down $5 billion from a private equity firm. Second, and even bigger, that Switzerland's Novartis will spend $39 billion for a majority stake in the U.S. eye care company Alcon. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay has the story.
The foreign funds that bought big chunks of Wall Street last year have lost a lot of money so far. Now a U.S. private equity firm, TPG, is hoping it can do a better job in timing a market turnaround with its investment in Washington Mutual. Greg Feinstein manages mergers and acquisitions at Houlihan Lokey.
I think it's a sign, certainly, that things have stabilized a little.
But Feinstein says the day's two deals do not signify the deal machine is roaring back. He says leverage buyouts are still dead. Feinstein says the Alcon deal is the kind of company-to-company sale that never stopped. Nestle is exiting the healthcare business, so it's selling its stake in Alcon to another Swiss company, Novartis, that is all about healthcare. Alcon is known for its Optifree contact lens solution, but Chris Cooley at FTN Midwest Security says Alcon really makes its money in cataract surgeries, where it dominates the $5 billion a year market.
They really have a potential to touch pretty much everyone at some point in time in their life. Most of us end up requiring either spectacles or contacts. But as we all age over time, the likelihood of the formation of a cataract obviously increases. It's the most common surgical procedure performed in the United States.
As the U.S. ages, that market is only going to get bigger. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
One more credit market note before we move on. Consumer credit this time. The Federal Reserve reported this afternoon consumers are being a bit more leery in their borrowing habits. What's called consumer credit, essentially everything except home loans, slowed in February to less than half its growth rate in January. Yes, that does still mean we are still borrowing, but way less than anybody thought we were. Back to the merger market now. The other deal news this Monday was of a deal not yet done. Microsoft's bid to take over Yahoo is still in play. It's just getting nastier. The software company set its first deadline over the weekend. 3 weeks, Microsoft said, or it's going to skip right past Yahoo management and go straight to shareholders. Today, Yahoo fired back of a sort. CEO Jerry Yang said it's not that Yahoo's necessarily opposed to working things out. It's just that the company would like more money first. Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
When the stakes are that high, business leaders rarely refer to each other by first name in official documents. But that's exactly what Yahoo executives did today in a letter that at one point addressed Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer by his first name. Technology analyst Rob Enderle says it takes the exchange to a new level.
It's becoming personal. It's becoming a battle between the two executive teams as to what the value of Yahoo is. This kind of thing typically does not end well.
Despite the tough rhetoric, Yahoo says it's still open to a deal as long as the price is right. The trouble is Microsoft's own value has sunk in the 2 months since its initial offer. That offer included both cash and Microsoft stock. Still, the overall offer is higher than Yahoo's current worth. And if Microsoft decides on a hostile takeover, it will likely be for even less. Stanford University business professor Chaim Mendelsohn says that's a scenario the software giant hopes to avoid.
Even in a friendly merger, we're talking about companies with very different cultures, very different approaches to doing business. It's obviously going to be more difficult and more costly if they go through a proxy fight as well.
Mendelsohn says Microsoft isn't likely to walk away since it sees the acquisition as key to competing with Google. But he says the uglier the battle becomes, the lower the chances for success. Mendelsohn says in the end, everyone still has to make up and live together under the same roof. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
President Bush has started the political clock ticking on his proposed Colombian free trade deal. The White House sent the agreement up to Capitol Hill for a vote. The rules say Congress has 90 days to decide what it wants to do. That is 90 legislative days, by the way, which means in real time, could take way longer. Oil bucked up almost $3 today, back over 109 a barrel. And the Energy Department said we're going to have record high gas prices this summer. But then again, you probably knew that, didn't you? On Wall Street today, traders gave back most of what had been a pretty nice midday rally. We will have the details when we do the numbers. No John Grisham, but Bill Lofelm's probably feeling pretty good himself about himself as an author today. The bartender and former high school teacher has won a contest sponsored by Penguin Books and Amazon.com. They've been trying to find the next big thing in fiction. Think American Idol for the literary set. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has the story.
Nearly 5,000 writers submitted manuscripts. Various editors whittled that number down to 10. From there, Amazon.com readers chose the winning entry to be published this summer. Tim McCall's with the contest co-sponsor, the publisher Penguin.
It's about getting into the real realm of the internet and finding out what popular opinion is all about. And the best way to bring them into our awareness is to get out there online and work with them and meet them and discover them.
The contest is also about goosing one of Amazon's businesses. All the authors who vied for the publishing contract and didn't win could be ripe targets for Amazon's burgeoning print-on-demand service, so says Michael Cater of Publishers Marketplace.
Because in many respects, this contest was launched as a thinly veiled way of supporting Amazon's print-on-demand subsidiary.
Cater says the billion-dollar self-publishing industry now is just a sliver of the book business, but it's growing as the publishing industry comes under pressure and cuts back on deals. Amazon's play for the self-publishing market has gotten the company into some hot water of late. Last week, it announced a plan that could push small and self-publishers into using Amazon's own self-publishing platform. Various author groups are crying foul, but footing the bill to publish his own book? That's something today's winner won't have to worry about. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
More than 500,000 people are going to get out of jail this year. A larger-than-usual percentage of them will be drug offenders, thanks in part to a ruling by the Supreme Court over sentences for crack cocaine. No matter what they were in for, though, job prospects for ex-cons are pretty dim. Since September 11th, companies have been running security checks on their hires, and even small businesses can use the Internet now to dig up an applicant's past. From KCUR in Kansas City, Sylvia Maria Gross reports on a group of business owners willing to give an ex-offender a second chance.
All right. Go ahead, have a seat. And I'll be doing
okay. Thanks. Right.
Steve Watson's been cutting hair since 1996. That's as long as he's had a criminal record. He didn't go to jail, but after his misdemeanor, barbering was one of the only jobs he could get.
in the first barbershop I worked at, we would get a lot of customers that come in that were fresh out of the jail. So after going through that and seeing, working in the business, that, hey, there's a need for people that are trying to do something with themselves, but there's not enough outlets.
So when Watson set up his own shop, he decided not to shy away from hiring people with criminal records. He knew firsthand how uncertain life could be for former offenders.
Once you get a job and been working for a week, a month, and then they come back with, well, we just did our background check and we got to let you go. What are you left to do?
I put in like 300 applications and I really didn't even get a call back.
That's Torin Marcus Riley. He served 5 years in prison for robbery. When he came out, he asked Watson to bring him on as an apprentice. Now Riley's working to earn his official license.
He took what he learned, passed it on to me, you know, because he went through it first. He's the man.
There are incentives for hiring ex-offenders. Companies can get tax credits, and a federal bonding program insures them for liability. Nicole Lindahl works at the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay College. She says many small business owners aren't as motivated by subsidies as they are by their own conscience.
They feel incredibly fortunate and they want to share that fortune with others who have been in similar situations to themselves.
What I will say, though, is if all you have is T-shirts and jeans and sneakers, cool.
Near downtown, a group of ex-offenders looking for jobs meet in a nonprofit agency.
That, man. Just come, you know what I'm saying? Just come crispy, at least. Come presentable, man.
It's run by Patrick Danley, a former drug dealer. He has 32 people on his staff, all volunteers. All have criminal records. And so do many of the employers he works with. Danley says business owners who are ex-offenders tend to be extremely vigilant about their employees.
Because they've been where they've been at, and they want to make sure that this person is not on drugs.
Ironically, Danley says a former drug dealer can make a standout employee.
He has extensive cash handling experience. He's able to work traditional and non-traditional hours. He has excellent problem-solving skills, conflict resolution skills.
And I'm just doing a light taper on the sides and the back and the shape up. Yeah.
Steve Watson, the barbershop owner, says ex-offenders often need careful handling, but not for the reasons you might expect.
You're going to have to be able to help them out as far as getting adjusted to society. You know, a lot of people when they get out, they mean well and they want to do better, so they're going to be hard on themselves.
Watson says many people in his community worry about how former convicts will fit in when they get out of prison. But, he says, given the right opportunity, they could become valuable employees, and they're much less likely to get in trouble again. In Kansas City, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
Coming up, religion, culture, and economics in China.
As with America's subjugation and integration or assimilation of Native American populations, the same thing is very much happening in Tibet and Xinjiang.
But first, let's do the numbers. Deal schmeals. After an up morning, the Dow Industrials eked out a gain of less than a tenth of 1% today. 3 points closed at 12,612. The NASDAQ backed off 0.2%, 6 points to end at 2364. The S&P 500 was up just a tenth of 1%, 2 points there. Finished at 1372. On the matchmaking front, Washington Mutual soared 29% on that news we told you about that it might get $5 billion cash on hand. Swiss drug maker Novartis lost 4% after agreeing to buy a huge share of the eye care company Alcon. Microsoft was flat after Yahoo said it wanted more money. Thank you. Worries over first quarter earnings brought out more bears. Alcoa kicked off the reporting period after the bell. The aluminum company said first quarter profit tumbled 54% because of surging energy costs, a weaker dollar, and lower metals prices. It traded down 4% today. Overseas markets were mixed. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on a bill to impose sanctions on countries that assist Iran in developing a nuclear program. What is the fiscal impact of immigration? A report is released to the National Press Club analyzing the costs to 15 federal departments and agencies. And former First Lady Betty Ford turns 90. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been a while since Congress and the White House have seriously considered a military draft, but there is a growing movement in favor of a national service program of some kind. Younger Americans would give a year to serve the country, maybe in the military, or maybe in a community service or education corps. The most enthusiastic advocates want any such program to be mandatory. Commentator, college freshman, and potential national service draftee Ben Kaznokas says they're sending a mixed message.
Listen carefully to those who hail the benefits of national service programs. It'll improve civic engagement, build national unity, instill duty and honor in America's youth. Isn't it strange how the conversation is always about the benefits to us? A few years ago, a Washington University report noted that nobody has really studied how broad service programs affect those actually being served. It suggests that in some cases, the local communities in which we're volunteering may be hurt more than helped. How so? Say an Uncle Sam-sponsored American comes along and offers to rebuild a dilapidated home in a poor area for free. What rational homeowner would say no? The community's happy and the subsidized volunteer feels good about himself. But what about the local builder who is charging market rate for the service? Sorry, he's out of a job. Temporary streams of volunteers can disrupt local labor markets over the long haul. One study of AmeriCorps, for example, suggests the positive impact may be only short-term. Now, national service is just a sliver of the total volunteer pie. Americans volunteered over 3 billion hours last year. The vast majority of these people did so without an order from the government. They worked with private nonprofits. Since they choose to volunteer for a specific local cause, these people are better able to create a long-term positive impact on the folks they serve. Nevertheless, John McCain and others want to nationalize volunteerism. There's an effort underway to pump up the social pressure. Advocates want to offer various financial incentives for kids to serve voluntarily for the United States. McCain talks about increased patriotism and serving one's country. So wait, is McCain's plan a nationalistic morale-building exercise? Are the benefits intended to flow primarily toward the servers or the served? Now, what's the point of an expensive government program that doesn't quite know whom it's trying to help? Let's stick with local, community-organized service programs and make sure those in need come first, and those who offer the services are contributing of their own volition.
Ben Kaznokas is the author of My Startup Life, What a Very Young CEO Learned on His Journey Through Silicon Valley. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. The political situation in Zimbabwe is no more clear today than it was at the end of last week. We still don't know who won the presidential elections of 10 days ago. After initially saying it would rule today, the country's highest court has put off until tomorrow a decision on whether election results will actually have to be published. Militant members of President Robert Mugabe's ruling party have raided the few remaining white-owned farms in that country. Meanwhile, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai is in South Africa today, meeting with politicians there. He's trying to build support for his claim that he won the election. If he did, he's got a heck of a job in front of him, convincing Zimbabweans that he can turn their shattered economy around and convincing other countries and foreign investors he's worth their time and money. We've reached economist Tony Hawkins in Harare. He teaches at the University of Zimbabwe. Mr. Hawkins, hello.
Good evening.
What's your sense about Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader? Do people perceive him to be up to this challenge?
It may depend.
depends where you stand. I think a lot of his critics believe he's not up to it because he's not a highly educated person. But the taste of the pudding really comes in the eating. The guys with the PhDs have been running the country for 28 years, and they've brought it to its knees. They've destroyed the economy, and they've created a highly corrupt society.
No matter what happens with this election, there are some economic issues that obviously have to be dealt with. Do you think fixing the Zimbabwe economy can happen without foreign aid?
No, certainly not. And I think this is why Mugabe has to go, because at the end of the day, there's no way that the international community is going to come to his assistance or his aid, but they will come to Mr. Tsvangirai's assistance.
How are they going to take care of inflation?
It is going to be a very, very tough challenge to tackle inflation, and it'll mean really radical surgery, like perhaps pegging the Zimbabwe dollar to a neighboring exchange like the South African rand. And, you know, we are expecting the Western governments, particularly the United States, Britain, and the EU, to throw money on the table quite quickly.
Assuming you get international assistance, what about private investment from overseas? Are they waiting now?
I think the answer to that is probably yes and no. Some of the sort of what you might call vulture investors are there. You can be sure of that. People who think you can come in and make a quick killing. I think the serious investment will sort of sit on the sidelines for a while and see what happens.
By all appearances, the people of Zimbabwe have been remarkably acquiescent, I guess, as the economy has been battered down there. How much more pain do you think they're ready for in an attempt to fix it?
I think that's a very real problem, because I think we will get a very short-term, I think, crisis of expectations. People are going to expect to see prices come down quickly. They're going to expect to see food back on the supermarket shelves. They're going to expect to see jobs being created in a very short time. And in the real world, I'm afraid, that's just not going to be possible. So it's going to have to be, the sort of change is going to have to be very well managed. They're going to need good public relations to sell the programs.
Do you imagine it's going to be a number of years yet before anything gets fixed?
I think the economy can turn around and start growing again quite quickly. But I think that to get back to where we were in the early or mid-1990s, it's going to take 8, 10, 12 years, something like that. So there's no quick fix from this sort of situation. But it's going to get better from compared with what it has been. That, I think, is the critical point.
Tony Hawkins is professor at the Graduate School of Management at the University of Zimbabwe. We reached him in Harare. Professor Hawkins, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
The controversy accompanying the Olympic torch has been hitting some of the world's most scenic landmarks today. This morning, it was the Eiffel Tower and the first of several confrontations in Paris. This afternoon, it was the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Activists climbed up into the cables to hang banners protesting Beijing's crackdown in Tibet. The world's attention is focused on Tibet, but discontent is rippling through other parts of China, too. In Xinjiang province next door, Muslim Uyghurs are asking for the same thing as Tibetans: religious freedom and economic opportunity. From China's Western Edge, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
1,000 years ago, the Xinjiang city of Kashgar was a bustling hub of the Silk Road, linking China to Rome and Persia. Today, it's quieter, but it's tense. Scores of unemployed men gather near a 15th-century mosque. They're ethnic Uyghurs. Their blood is largely Turkish, their religion Islam. But the map says they're part of China. Chinese police and informants patrol here, just in case anyone whispers separatism. Security in Kashgar has tightened since unrest in Tibet last month. And like Tibet, one volatile ingredient here is a broad sense of economic injustice. At this construction site, just about every worker is of Chinese Han descent, imported from Sichuan province. The handful of Uyghur locals includes this man we'll call Ali.
I make $7 a day. The Han Chinese make double or triple that, and they give us the harder work, the heavier lifting.
The Uyghurs once far outnumbered Han Chinese, but it's now 50-50 in the province, thanks to a stream of migrants from the east. Parag Ghana is author of The Second World.
As with America's subjugation and integration or assimilation of Native American populations, the same thing is very much happening in Tibet and Xinjiang.
The Han Chinese finance Shanghai-style shopping strips, sometimes where ancient Uyghur homes once stood. And perhaps more important, they build highways and rails and pipelines to feed critical natural resources inland.
Xinjiang actually contains China's largest deposits of oil, gas, coal, uranium, and gold.
Last year, the economy grew 12%. The income per capita is $2,300, well above the national average. Xinjiang realtor Wen Lijing.
Everyone shares in the economic boom. We share the same goal, to improve our lives.
Yeah.
Just don't tell that to this 55-year-old Uyghur laborer. He unloads trucks and picks cotton, whatever odd jobs he can find. But the jobs are down, and inflation is up. He can't afford to buy lamb anymore, just bread and tea.
2 days ago, I made $3. Today, nothing. And I can't find jobs for my sons. A lot of people go through the back door, but I can't afford that.
Translation, he can't pay bribes the way the wealthy Han Chinese can. An unfamiliar car cruises by and he clams up. Can't be too careful here. But as one Uyghur put it, the more Chinese come and take our jobs, how long can we stay quiet? In Kashgar, on the western edge of China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand homeowner reviews on local contractors like plumbers, painters, and movers. Details at angieslist.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, when they eventually march into Olympic Stadium in Beijing this summer, American athletes might be wearing a little polo pony on the breast pockets of their uniforms. Polo Ralph Lauren is expected to announce it's going to be outfitting the U.S. Olympic team this year. It replaces the Canadian clothing company Roots. Roots has had the contract for the past three games. So expect a preppier look out on the playing field this summer. Less nylon, more seersucker maybe. I don't know. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow skated up 3 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 rose just a fraction. We'll call that a 10%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, going on the hunt for cheap eats.
The great drivers of our eating habits are, can you save me time or can you save me money? And right now, it's focusing more on the money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.